I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. Hi, everybody. It's the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. We're not talking about a particular album today, but we are here with Jim West. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Mahalo to you, as we say in Hawaii. Aloha.
So you've been with the band, with Weird Al's band. Let's just make that clear. You're Weird Al's guitarist. Have been since 1984.
Yep. No, since 81.
81?
Well,
the internet is
82,
full of crap.
Really.
Okay.
Actually, yeah, I would
screw
say 82.
Screw the internet. Why
yeah.
does it mislead me this way? You see, this is why we're doing this. So give me the history of yourself as a guitarist and then into Weird Al's band.
Well, I grew up in Florida, and my older brother, I have a brother who's 10 years older, and you know, he sort of noodled around on guitar. And I think he sort of got tired of it and left it in the closet. And one day when I was about 12, I picked it up and it's like, hey, this is cool. It only had like three strings on it. But he, you know, he saw I was interested in it. So he went out and got a set of strings and a book and, you know, just some accessories. And I just was, you know, entranced. And I just, you know, locked myself in my room and played, you know, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then I got into, shortly after that, I got into electric guitar,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I had, you know, eventually got myself a Les Paul and a Marshall amp and started playing in little bands. I think I played my first professional gig when I was 16 and, you know, and it was, I had started college actually when I was 16 and I was an art major, but, you know, I was playing rock and roll too at night, and it was like, you know, this rock and roll thing is a lot more fun than that art thing. You know? So I just followed my muse, you know, just kept playing rock and roll. And I never stopped playing acoustic because that's what I started on was acoustic guitar.
Mm-hmm.
So I always liked playing acoustic. And so I, like I said, I grew up in Florida, played in a lot of bands. I had some very good gigs and had a lot of respect there where I was. Of course, it's a, you know, smaller town than mm-hmm. Los Angeles.
Sure.
And then I was playing Steve Jay, the bass player. We played together in bands in Florida. You know, we knew each other in Florida.
Were these just rock bands?
Yeah, just rock bands.
Okay.
You know, I think the one we were in, we did a lot of originals too. But we, you know, it was a rock circuit as opposed to like a lounge band.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, you know, it was a respectable band, you know. But anyway, we were friends, and he had moved out to Los Angeles. He had a chance to audition for Frank Zappa. We were playing in this big club in Florida, and Frank Zappa had come in a couple of times, actually, and came in, you know, and took our phone numbers, you know, because he finds musicians like
yeah.
that. He used to, you know, that's how he used to find players sometimes. And, you know, he did end up calling Steve. Steve came out to L.A. to audition for Zappa. He didn't get the job, but he decided he'd, you know, stay there.
Sure.
So Steve, while he was, you know, he had come, he was new to L.A., but he'd met some other musicians and was playing gigs, and he met a band, some guys who needed a guitar player, and then he said, well, I know a really great guitar player, but he's back in Florida. So we started communicating, and
mm-hmm.
And I decided, you know, they had jobs, they had work, you know,
yeah.
So I said, well, sounds good. I'll just, you know, move out to L.A. and start playing, you know. So that got me to L.A.
Yeah.
And that was like around 81.
Uh-huh.
Quite a while ago. So anyway, I got to L.A. and started playing. And, you know, the band went through a few incarnations. But shortly after that, Steve said, called me and said, hey, I met this guy, Weird Al, and he plays accordion, and he's looking for a guitar player. He's going to audition some guitar players. So I said, what? And he said, yeah, he's this guy who plays accordion, and, you know, and it's like, oh. You know, at that time, I was kind of like, yeah, well, if he's got a gig that pays, sure,
yeah,
you know,
of course.
I'll come down and whatever, you know, because I think I was playing in four bands. I was in a punk band and a, you know, various different bands, you
mm-hmm.
know, all, you know, just trying to scrape by and make a living. So anyway, yeah, I auditioned for him and learned a few of his tunes, and he called me one day and said, well, you got the gig, and I was like, okay, you know, whatever, you know, but he did have some paying gigs, but as I, you know, started working on learning his stuff, I did realize that it's like, oh, you know, this is very well crafted, you know, it's not just, it's well done. You know, the lyrics were well done. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't put together quickly. It was really well thought out stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and I immediately, you know, developed a lot of respect for what he does. And it was, of course, the last thing I was expecting to do coming to L.A. You know, a serious guitar player, like, what am I going to play in this, you know, comedy band? But at the time, it was, you know, I was still playing in other bands.
Sure,
too,
sure. Know?
So we were, I was, it was just one of the things I was doing. And then his first record was already made, pretty much made. I think I might have contributed some clap, hand claps or something
really?
To
okay.
it. But
I love it.
That was the very first record that had the single Ricky on it. Mm-hmm. You know? So we did the video for Ricky. And then, of course, the beginning of MTV, mm-hmm. you know, there weren't a lot of videos out there. So it got a lot of airplay on MTV. And then we got a little tour, you know. And I think if our first tour was opening for Dr. Demento, because, of course, Dr. Demento was, you know, helped Al in his career
sure.
a lot, you know. So we did a little tour in the Northeast, and I might have done a couple tours like that, very small, you know, basically, you know, driving around in station wagons and RVs and things like that, you
yeah.
know. But then, you know, it was we were started working on the next record, which was in 3D, and there it is right there.
Yes, sir.
And then once that record came out, then of course, you know, with Eat It was a big hit and everything. And then, you know, then all of a sudden, you know, the whole thing ramped up and we were on tour buses and,
mm-hmm.
And you know, the story continues from there. It just sort of, Al's career and you know, and all of our careers because of Al, there's sort of a slow ramp, you know, this long, slow ramp over a 30-year period.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So, you know, that's essentially, you know, how I came into the band and more or less, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So how, because I know so little about music, so I apologize. There are going to be some dumb questions in terms of the music stuff. But how orchestrated were these from the beginning? Like, what are you getting? Are you getting like full, like everything's realized? Or did you get to make any of it your own?
Well, you know, on the parodies, of course, we're going to try and make them, you know, as close to the record as possible.
Sure.
I think we weren't, you know, quite as finicky about it in the early days. You know, we were just, you know, I certainly wasn't too finicky about it. It was like, you know, I wasn't going to be too finicky. But on the original songs, you know, there definitely was room to make it your own. You know,
okay.
Al had, you know, he'd have certain specific ideas and melodies and things like that, But and over the years, it's always been the same. On the originals, you know, we do contribute, you know, we try and give him what he wants, but we also, you know, just by default, we'll be making it our own. You
sure.
know? So we have a lot of our own musicality in those originals, you know. But of course, like I say, the parodies are, you know, especially nowadays, in the last four or five records, we were, you know, very, very particular about trying to make them so perfect that
yeah.
nobody would ever know when it went, or totally they would be fooled when it came on the radio.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we're very, very particular about that.
I'm going to apologize to my listeners because I bring up this example a lot, but that moment in Trapped in the Drive-Thru where you guys had to recreate that bit of Black Dog, like, what was that? is that typical? Is that just like, no, this is what we normally do? Or did you guys go to any particular length to make it identical? Because it's unmistakably sounds the same.
Well, yeah, you know, it wasn't too hard, really, because that track, I had been a Led Zeppelin fan for years, and I knew it. You know, I knew I knew the song already.
Sure.
You know, I knew a lot of the Zeppelin material, and it's, you know, as production wise, it was very simple. It's really just bass, drums, and guitar. You
sure.
know, there's not much else going on.
Yeah.
You know? And so it was. It was very quick. We recorded it very quickly, and it was a lot of fun.
I you know, and that's so funny because in my brain, I'm like, "That's the most amazing thing in the world." And you're like, "Yeah, but this is what I do. I can do this. This is what I do." Early on, my goodness, like, so what did you think when you first heard accordion? Were you like, "Is this polka?" Like, did you have any concept of what the hell was going on before you got in there?
Well, when Steve first told me about this guy who's looking for a guitar player, accordion player, it's like, I don't know what, you know, I was very, but you know, once I saw what he was doing, I mean, he was basically, you know, Al's a rock and roll artist. You know, he was playing rock and roll on accordion, and I could totally, you know, that was his instrument. And
yeah.
But he wasn't playing, you know, even though he did his polka medleys, you know, he really loved to play rock and roll on his accordion. So that was all cool with me, you know. And eventually he went from accordion, he started playing some keyboards live, you know. And he'll be doing more of that on this upcoming tour. You know?
Oh, that seems like an amazing tour.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Do you have since we discussed it last time before it was announced, I think even Bermuda just like kind of was kind enough to just tell us all about what it's going to be. So many originals.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite original or a few favorite originals that are fun to play for you particularly?
Oh, gee, I don't know. There's so many.
I hate asking that question.
It's really
open-ended.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many that, I mean, I tend to like the, you know, the rocking ones a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to like the stuff that really rocks and the heavier stuff, but oh, I don't know. It'd be really hard to, you know, to choose one. Mm-hmm. And we're, like I say, we're going to be doing almost entirely Al's originals on this tour. And many of them we have not played before ever.
Yeah.
So we're, and we're going to try and have the show different every night.
Oh my.
So it requires, you know, learning a lot of songs,
yeah.
You know, I've saw, you know, a certain number of our ones we've done before, but I would say the vast majority are ones we've never played live.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So it's going to be fun. Al will definitely play some accordion, but you know, he'll be using that. He's got a MIDI accordion, I think, where he can play regular accordion and he can play other keyboard parts on there, too.
Oh, my God, that's insane. I didn't know that even existed.
Yeah.
I had a guest here yesterday, and we were talking about Running with Scissors just because it was an Al. That was his first Weird Al.
Mm-hmm.
That's how much younger he is than me. And I'm like, okay, all right, I guess we could start there. That's fine. Because I love that album, but this is where my brain starts, is in 3D. And we're just talking so much about how he could have leaned on the accordion as a crutch, as a thing that he does all the time, constantly. But eventually he sort of moved away from it as his signature thing. Was that conscious? Was that something?
Oh, yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, I think he I think he liked the idea of just being up there and singing, and that he could do a lot more that way because he wasn't holding the accordion. He could do different costumes.
Sure.
He could do, you know, when you're going to have an accordion on, for example, you really can't put the fat suit on and play the accordion. There was so much more available to him. I mean, I've never really asked him this, but I could imagine that that he had so many more options. And of course, dancing and moving around and physical comedy, costumes, all that stuff. You know, there's so many more options. You know, and you know, when you have a full band, you got bass, drums, keyboards, and guitar. It's like, well, doesn't have to always have accordion, you know.
Sure.
There's plenty of noise being made on stage, so but I think primarily it just gave him a lot more freedom to be away from the accordion and then pick it up on certain songs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the polka, of course, would always have the accordion, the polka medleys.
Sure.
Yoda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certain songs, so he would pick the accordion up, you know, here and there on certain things. And but it just gave him a lot more variety, and it gave the audience more, you know, more variety, something to see, you know, something different rather than just being an accordion the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever performed with anybody, maybe that's a dumb question, but have you ever performed with anybody whose work you've played parodies of with Weird Al?
Oh,
gee. I feel like that would happen. I feel like you'd have to run into somebody.
Well, we've run into, you know, different people, but over the years, but I don't think we've ever... Gee, that's a good question. Now, Bermuda would probably really know this for sure, but I don't know that we've ever, like, done a... First of all, we haven't done many shows where we're doing a co-billing with anybody,
sure, of course,
you know?
Yeah.
So we did one year, we toured with the Monkees. I think it was one of the
only... Yeah.
But we never did any Monkees covers. But maybe at some festivals, possibly, where there's tons of different bands, it's quite possible, you know.
Makes sense, yeah.
But I can't think of a real example right now. But Al's definitely, you know, friends with a lot of the people that, you know, bands that he's parodied before.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And you know, I'm sure he's met lots of those folks.
Have you ever felt, do you ever, or did you ever early on feel a need to try and be funny, or were you just, you knew your utility as a guitar player? I'm curious, because like...
No, you know, our job in the band is just to play music, and, you know, if Al's got a little gag he wants to do with this, you know, he's the funny one, you mm-hmm. know, because, you know, for the rest of us, we're just not that funny. I mean, we may think we're funny, but, uh-huh. you know... He's miles ahead of us in the comedy department, so we leave that up to him. And you know, it's just we, you know, what we could do comedy wise wouldn't hold a candle to what he does. So we just let him be the comedy artist, and we just try, you know, we just play the music pretty straight, you know.
Yeah. But you at least get to enjoy the crap out of yourselves. I mean, watching you guys play is my favorite concert.
Yeah. It's very enjoyable, and you know, you get to play all these different styles and sort of be different characters in a song sometimes. Mm-hmm. And Al, you know, sometimes we do get involved in some, you know, funny bits here mm-hmm. and there, you know, and. So I'm sure there'll be more of that this tour. I don't know what, but we'll see.
Sure. I'm trying to think back, and now, of course, my mind's blanking over this many albums, but is there any... I feel like there have been some guitar parts that were built as, like, gags, like something where you had to be just insane, do something really super crazy on the guitar, like, not just mimicking.
Well,
something.
I was actually practicing a song today that we were gonna... that we might play called The Generic Blues.
Yeah.
And, you know, and, you know, I basically play the whole song straight, and I launch into a great blues solo. But then when it comes to the chord change, I hang on this, like, this riff that's just very monotonous, sort of a tritone riff. And then I just keep playing it, even though it goes back to the other chords. And,
okay.
And, you know, and then I think Al walks over and, you know, and did like an eye poke or something or hit me or something like that. But it was just, you know, it starts off like a great guitar solo, and all of a sudden it gets really stupid. You know? Mm-hmm.
I love that so yeah. much.
And every so often, I mean, in the old days, we, you know, oftentimes Al would just yell out drum solo, you know, uh-huh. or, you know, so if you were called on to do a solo, that it would be, you'd have to do something really stupid.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
You know? And it could be anything as long as it was, you know, not a normal solo.
Okay,
you know?
Yeah.
And I used to, like, I think for a while what I would do, I'd sort of get all amped up like I was going to, like, blast out some crazy rock, you know, and then I'd start doing the tuning thing, you know, it's like, like really monotonous, you know, just like, oh God, you can't get it in tune, you know. You know, and then I think I started playing like Mary Had a Little Lamb or uh-huh. something really like inane.
I love that so much. I mean, that in and of itself is a contribution that, like, just elevates it so much. Are you going to be relieved to not do costumes?
Yeah, you know, it'll be different. Although, you know, the costume breaks, putting on the costumes, you know, were done. The costume changes were done during videos. You know,
sure, sure. Yeah.
So there was kind of a nice thing about, even though it was you were running back, and you were very pressed for time, and, mm-hmm. and you know, and you have to make sure you put on the right costume because you'd come out with the wrong one, and it would be very embarrassing.
Of course.
But you know, but it was kind of interesting kind of nice to be able to run off stage a number of times during the show, you know, and you're off stage and you're out of the limelight for a little bit, you mm-hmm. know, and you know, you can blow your nose or whatever,
sure,
do something, you know,
sure.
And whatever. It was kind of nice to actually to get off stage. So it's been a long time since we haven't had costume changes. So it'll be interesting to, you know, to see how that feels, just being up there the whole
sure,
time.
Sure. Yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it'll be different, yeah.
Be as close to, like, an unplugged type set as you're going to get,
I would imagine.
Yeah,
well, I mean, in the old days, we didn't do costume changes, and we did a short show, and mm-hmm. we were just up there the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I love that so much. I cannot, for the life of me, imagine what it was like touring with you group of guys. 'Cause now, you know, now it's cool to call yourself a nerd. Al seems to have always been that guy. I don't know. Are there any other guys in the group who have that sort of same mentality, who are kind of nerdy? I mean, I feel like to appreciate the music that you're doing and to know that much variety of music, you kind of have to be.
Well, you know, Bermuda is, I mean, I wouldn't call him a nerd, but he's a music nerd in a way that, you know, like Dr. Demento was.
Sure.
You know, I mean, he's a very, you know, a collector, and he knows a lot of music history and trivia, mm-hmm. and things like that, you know. So in that respect, you know, he's the guy in the band, and he's the one who documents everything.
Yeah.
And you know, he's got recordings of every rehearsal, and you know, he's, you know, if you ever want to know a date of a particular show or something, you just, you know, he's the guy to call, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
He's got it all documented, you know.
It's crazy.
Yeah,
that's one of my favorite things to do, is meet archivists too. Through the, do you yourself, do you have, I mean, everybody's got mementos, do you have like a little shoebox of stuff?
Yeah, you know, I've got so much stuff saved up over the years. I don't, you know, have a, I could have so much more, but I, mm-hmm. you know, there's certain things I save, and I've got boxes and boxes of stuff, and you know, mostly up in the attic, you know, but I've got mm-hmm. I've got a lot of things and stuff that going back to the very first days, you know.
That's like great.
You know, Bermuda is the one who really has that archive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he really has a huge archive of stuff.
Do you think you would have kept that stuff if somehow it hadn't taken off? If somehow the career of the band had not...
Well, you know, I back when I first started playing with Al, I was playing in a lot of different bands. And I recently was going through some stuff in my attic, and I found a box from, you know, sort of a time capsule from those days. And
mm-hmm.
I had saved a lot of clippings from a number of different shows I was in besides Al, you know. I played like in a couple, you know, these punk thing for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I found a lot of, you know, stuff. I'd save clippings like that and things like that and articles. So, yeah, you know, I don't know if I have anything from those very first shows, but I'm sure there were some, you know, some mementos to be had from then.
Sure.
But certainly from when we started touring, you know, I've got bits and pieces of things. And of course, you know, I think there was always a tour t-shirt of some kind.
Of course,
you know?
Of course,
so,
it's got to be, right?
So I'm sure I've got a couple of those from the original tour, you know.
That's great. I love that. I mean, that stuff is so much fun, not just to look back at, but there's going to be a day when there's going to be a museum where that shit's going to be important.
Yeah,
you know
exactly,
what I mean?
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
What's your experience with comedy, at least going back, like when you, what kind of stuff were you listening to or watching as a kid? Did you have any comedy albums?
Well, you know, my older brother, like I said, was, you know, he's 10 years older than me. He was, he had a lot of records, you know, so, and he bought novelty records. He,
uh-huh.
he had some crazy novelty records, you know, you know, Alan Sherman comes
to
mind,
sure.
and stuff like that. So, the first comedy records I heard were stuff of his, you
mm-hmm.
know, and I really enjoyed, you know, I loved it. The first music I was into as a kid, you know, were his comedy records, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I really wasn't into the regular music, you know, and he had all kinds of comedy records. You know, he had other stuff too. He was a folk music fan and all
okay.
that stuff too, but he had a lot of comedy things, and I certainly remember the Alan Sherman stuff, and I can't think of what else, but there were definitely a number of other quirky comedy records. I'm sure, you know, Sheb Woolley and the Purple People
oh, sure,
Eater
sure.
and all those, you know, those were all probably all on 45s. And
mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was some of the first music that I actually, you know, liked, you know,
yeah.
as far as, you know, when you come to an age where all of a sudden you go, yeah, that's, you know, I like this music, you know. So that was probably some of the first stuff that caught my ear was
that's
comedy
great.
Music, you know. And, you know, and then once I got into playing guitar, then I, you know, I became more focused in the musical, you know, normal guitar music and rock and roll and all that.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I've always appreciated, you know, I wouldn't say over the years I was a big collector of comedy records, but I always appreciated, you know, like quirky rock that had a comedic or a witty kind of a comedic
sure,
bent.
Sure.
You know, there was a lot of great rock and roll that had, you know, great witty lyrics, and you know, I always enjoyed, you know, that kind of rock and roll, you
mm-hmm.
know, and those kind of rock and roll lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
I liked stuff like that, and stuff that made you think, and stuff that was, you know, irony and satire and stuff in rock and roll. And I think I remember as a kid, you know, listening to the Fire Sign Theater records.
Sure.
You know, that era of comedy records. That was always, you know, very entertaining stuff. That sort of was a new direction in comedy. It was a very sort of cutting edge, you know, material compared to, you know, your old standard comedy records.
For sure. Was that also passed down from your brother?
No, that was something that I forget where somebody, I think when I had my first apartment, somebody had some Fire Sign Theater records.
Okay.
I got into them, you know, probably when I was, you know, 18 or something like that.
Sure.
You know?
It's a good age.
Yeah. And you know, and then around 1985, I went to Hawaii. That's started my Hawaii connection. And where I was staying, three doors down, this couple lived in, who was a very famous comedian, Bill Dana.
Yeah.
Who recently passed away.
I was going to bring him up.
Yeah. Well, Bill became a really close friend of mine because he was my neighbor.
Wow.
In Hawaii. And I ended up... we collaborated on a record together. I produced a record for him for the Rhino label.
Okay.
And this was probably in the early 90s did this. And we, what we did was we, you know, he had a number of songs. You know, one thing he used to complain about with comedy is that there was no royalties paid, music royalties. Like if you were a songwriter or a lyricist, you could get royalties for that.
Makes sense.
For that composition. Whereas comedy... he didn't get any royalties. It was just the record company would get the master royalties. So he had always written songs, and he had actually been living in Hawaii for quite a while and had written some well-known kind of touristy kind of Hawaiian songs.
Interesting. Okay.
So he had a lot of tunes of all kinds, and so we, you know, he wanted to make this record a mixture of. Of these songs, comedic songs, and then sort of some old stuff from some of his old records, you know, intermixed in there. And it was on the Rhino label. It was called Jose, Can You See?
Oh, yes, there we go. I did see that, yeah.
Yeah, and so we had a really good time making it, and it was a lot of fun, you know. And I worked with him over the years on a number of different things, not any time recently, but... But, you know, was always friends with Bill. And, of course, you know, in his era, that was sort of a little before my time, but he was, you know, he was like the number one comic
for
a while. I mean, he was really on top of the world of comedy. And I think he started off as a writer on the Steve Allen Show.
Wow, yeah.
Huh. You know, going way back. And then I think he might have debuted his Jose Jimenez character on that show.
Okay.
And then he went on to be a staff writer for a lot of shows like Get Smart and a lot of comedic sitcoms. And he wrote for Laugh-In. And but he was a very talented guy and a guy with so many ideas and a funny guy to be around.
Did he know what you did? Did he understand like your work in comedy? Because I feel sometimes there could be a generational gap, but he got it. That's good.
Oh yeah, you know, I'm sure he did come to an Al show before. I'm sure I can't remember if he did. I think he did, but he loved Al and had a, you know, they knew each other and they had become friends. Bill was a great comedy connection for me, you know, like I say, he was coming sort of from another era, but
sure.
Very funny guy, fun guy to hang out with, and I still use a lot of his jokes.
Really? I was trying for years to get him on the podcast, and I don't know, did they ever finish that autobiography? Did he ever finish that? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't.
Because that's something I feel like it'd be good to talk about on the show, you know, at some point. I'd like to.
I could find out. You know, his wife, Evie, is a friend of mine, so I could find out.
Yeah, I'd love to know.
They had been living in Nashville for quite a long time.
Okay.
And, but yeah, Bill was, he was in that, that whole crowd of comedic entertainers, you know, and Carol Burnett and all people, you know, and sort of the same group, you know.
Have you, over the years, had opportunities to meet any of your musical heroes? I wonder if that's happened for you, because I can't tell what circles you guys would travel more in, comedy circles or music circles as
a group. Well, you know, mostly music circles, just because that's where we're playing, you know, music venues as opposed to, like, in the very beginning, we did play some comedy clubs, you know, very small places, but of course, as the venues got bigger, we, you know, but, you know, we've hung out with a lot of different people, you know, over the years. You know, usually it'll be like at a festival or something where there's a lot of different acts, you know, and then we'll run into somebody, you know, it's Dave Grohl, or run into various people who are playing. And sometimes the big festivals will have like a common artist area backstage.
Sure.
You know? So you run into various different people, you know. You know, as far as guitar heroes, and I don't, you know, I've never really, I can't really think of any in particular other than, you know, the people from my Hawaiian slack key world. And that's a very small world, so I kind of know all them, you know.
Sure, sure.
But yeah, you know, I haven't really been, you know, it was an honor to meet Frank Zappa years ago. I was always a huge fan of Frank Zappa, so that was pretty cool, you know. Mm-hmm. But I didn't, you know, I was never friends with him. I just happened to meet him once, you know. But yeah, that's cool. And like I say, in the acoustic guitar world, I have a lot of, you know, a lot of the Hawaiian slack key players are people I've known for years and, you know, respected, so.
We should talk about that a little bit, because before we started recording, you gave me so much information about slack key guitar. I tried to look it up online, and it didn't explain it enough, but you gave me pretty solid explanation. So where's that obsession come from, and like, what's your evolution with guitar?
Well, what happened was I went to Hawaii just as a fluke in 1985, and I went to this very small town called Hana on Maui. Mm-hmm. And it's very remote, and it's a very Hawaiian place, very beautiful. There's, you know, one gas station, a couple little stores, and no traffic lights or anything like that. It's very quiet, but where I was staying, the people I was staying with, they had a large collection of Hawaiian music records. This is all vinyl. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of that was Hawaiian slack key. You know, I'd heard the term before, but I really didn't really know much about it. But I really just loved listening to it. I just thought, you know, this music sounds like this place, what I'm seeing and feeling in this place is exactly what this music says, you know. And so I was really sort of enchanted with that music, but I didn't really, for a number of years, I didn't really try and play it. I just enjoyed it, just liked to listen to it, you know. And I understood what it was about, because I could understand. I had played in different open tunings before, you know, maybe just open G or open E or things like that. Usually it's for slide or playing bottleneck, you know. I used to do a lot of that. But so anyway, I started eventually, probably in the mid-90s, I started playing slack key and writing my own slack key tunes. Mm-hmm. And that became, those tunes that I wrote became my first CD, which is called Coconut Hat. And that was, I think, released in like 98 or 99. But anyway, this whole slack key guitar thing, like I said, I didn't know much about it when I came to Hawaii, but then I started learning about how it started and what had happened in the, Hawaii was not discovered by Europeans until 1780 something, 87 or something, you know, pretty late on, because many of the explorers and Spanish and Portuguese people had been all through the Pacific, all the way over to the Philippines, and, you know, way before that. But Hawaii is so isolated. It's very tiny dot. There's so much open ocean around it.
Sure.
That it was very easy to miss, you know. But anyway, so Captain Cook, you know, discovered Hawaii in the late 1700s. And then one of the next explorers, George Vancouver, he decided on his trip to bring 3 head of cattle to give to King Kamehameha as a gift.
Okay.
And 2 cows and a bull. They didn't have cattle. They didn't have any large mammals in Hawaii. They had pigs, you know, small pigs. That's about it. So anyway, they gave the king these cattle, and the king made them kapu, meaning nobody could touch them, you know, the property of the king. Anyway, so over the years, these three cattle became a herd of cattle.
Uh-huh.
Now, at some point, they escaped out of their confines and became feral. You know, they'd be all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And the common people, the regular people couldn't do anything about it because they belonged to the king, right?
Yep.
So they were terrorizing everybody, and they were, you know, tearing up all the vegetable patches, and they're really causing a lot of problems. So a number of years later, in the 1820s, late 1820s, early 1830s, King Kamehameha III was the descendant of Kamehameha. He had come over to San Francisco on a ship, you know, as some of the royalty were starting to go to the mainland, you know, mm-hmm. and even England. And they he saw these Mexican, in those days, California was owned by Mexico.
Sure.
So he saw these vaqueros, these Mexican cowboys, managing cattle, roping them and everything. So he said, I need to get these guys, some of these guys over to teach my people how to do this. So he contracted a number of these vaqueros,
mm-hmm.
and they put them on they came on the ship with their ponies and their saddles mm-hmm. and everything, and they had some guitars with them. And the Hawaiians had never seen an instrument really before. You know, the missionaries had been there a few years before, and they were mostly just teaching them hymns and mm-hmm. singing. You
okay.
know? So at the end of the day, they'd be sitting around, and, you know, the vaqueros would break out the guitars, and the Hawaiians were just transfixed.
Yeah.
So they, anyway, the Hawaiians learned how to become incredible cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
And this was early on.
Yeah.
And 1830s. And they learned, in fact, the Hawaiian cowboy predates the American cowboy by about 15 or 20 years.
Makes sense, but I wouldn't have thought of that. It's amazing.
Yeah. The Hawaiians became very, very expert cowboys. In fact, one of the first big rodeos held in Wyoming, three Hawaiian guys came over from Hawaii to be in this rodeo.
Mm-hmm.
And they cleaned up. They won like first place and third place.
Wow.
And one guy only had one arm.
Oh my God, wow.
And so everybody was going, who are these guys from Hawaii? You know, what's up with that?
Wow.
So anyway, the Hawaiians, when the vaqueros left after their job was done, they went back and they left their guitars with the Hawaiians because mm-hmm. the Hawaiians were so enamored of them. And the Hawaiians didn't really know how to tune them. They just tuned them to whatever sounded good, which is usually like an open chord of some kind. And they developed their own style of playing. And they call it ki hoalo, which is basically loosen the key. They didn't have a word for key, but they just called it ki, K-I. Ki hoalo, loosen the key. And they would create their own tunings and lower the strings down so that it sort of you could sort of have bass notes in there and everything. So they could, with one guitar, they could sort of play like a whole band sound. So the idea with slack key is you're playing the bass notes and you're playing chords and you're playing the melody all at once.
Crazy, okay.
So that became a style, and it was very... the different families would all have their own tunings, and they'd keep them secret. And it wasn't performed. It wasn't like you'd go to a bar and hear people playing slacky. It was just played at home. You know?
Okay.
And it was only passed on from a father to a son, or from a relative, like an uncle to a nephew.
Okay.
You couldn't learn slacky nobody would teach you unless it was a family member. So they kept it within the family. I remember there's a great story about Raymond Connie, who was a famous slack key player, and he didn't have anybody in his family that taught him. He heard this guy playing slack key, and he didn't have any family members that knew how to play.
Mm-hmm.
So he eventually bribed the guy to teach him, because Ray was a good spear fisherman, so he bribed the guy with fish. He said,
Look,
I'll keep bringing you fish every day if you teach me some of that slack key.
Wow.
So anyway, it was an interesting kind of music that... And it wasn't even recorded until about 1940, but it was, and it was never really performed except, like I say, at home. And then, you know, once you got into the 70s or so, people started playing it out, playing in mm-hmm. bands, and, you know, it became more of a common thing to see. But it has an interesting story, and it's like he, in the early, late 1800s, a young guy named Joseph Kekuku learned how to, he figured he could put that guitar in that open tuning on his lap and play it with this steel bar, and that became steel guitar.
That's nuts.
And which of course became popular and now is in like every country record. And
yeah,
that all came from Slack Key as well. So it's got a very deep history. It goes back even before the blues. It's older than the blues, really.
It's musically so similar to what has, I mean, everybody has said this term, but the lonesome whistle of a train. It's so significantly, like, especially the steel guitar specifically.
Yeah,
but, you know, once you get to that, it's just so, just the plaintive cry of this thing. It's just like,
Steel guitar is a whole different sound. Slack Key is more of a finger-picking sound, but it's very beautiful, and like I say, it really sounds like the place. And steel guitar, when you hear Hawaiian steel guitar and you're on the beach of Waikiki and you're having a Mai Tai and the trade winds are blowing and the coconut leaves are swaying, and I mean, it's like that steel guitar is like, that is the sound. That is a perfect musical description of what I'm seeing.
I love that. It's so good. It's not often that you get that opportunity where, like, that's a perfect parallel to everything.
Yeah, it really is. I think Hawaiian music sounds more like the place than any music, you know, to me. I mean, I haven't heard any music that sounds more like the actual place.
Mm-hmm. You know? I feel like that might be a similar, and I could be stretching here, but similar reason why, if I ever have anybody come on this show, and believe me, I have a lot of people who come on the show who want to talk about your guys' music. We all come from different backgrounds, different types of thing. We can be nerds or not nerds. We might be interested in comedy. We might be interested in music. There is something about, at the very least in our brains, this stuff kind of illustrates what's going on inside our heads, you know, and it does kind of make you feel at home in this, in a similar way. I would not say that I could sit and relax to any of your guys' music, but it definitely brings me back to a certain, like, a very specific place,
right?
You know, and I think there's something to be said for comedy music. It's one of the reasons it's going to last longer probably than all the stuff I've got on this wall here. I feel like the comedy music, is much as I love all this stuff, the comedy music's going to keep going.
Absolutely. And there's always, it's uncharted territory. Anything can happen. It's all and, like, with Al, you know, his stuff is, you know, you're commenting on what's going on at the moment in the world, you know. So that's all. It's always going to be different. There's always going to be something to comment on. That's for sure.
Absolutely. I love also just, there are so many levels of subtlety to some of the stuff you guys do, and then also there will be ones that are less subtle but also really good. I think I brought it up when Bermuda was here, but Trigger Happy is one of my favorite things of all time.
it's genius
It's genius and played so perfectly, so spot-on.
and it's you know, it's an older tune, but it's still very relevant, you know. It's still it makes sense, you know. It's it'll be fun to play that. Well, I'm not sure I think we're going to play.
I hope so. Oh my goodness. Oh, I love it so much. So over the years then, has all your solo stuff been just Slack Key?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, it's all based on Slack Key guitar, and it's all instrumental. The record that I brought you today, Guitar Stories, is a little bit of a diversion. Its basis is in Slack Key, but it goes into some other musical styles.
Okay.
There's one track on there that's almost sort of a Middle Eastern sound, and
really,
you know, one that's a little more of a West African. But so this one's a little more of a Slack Key meets world music, and
that's cool.
You know, it's more of an adventurous thing. It was just something that, you know, I decided, well, you know, I have a lot of other musical interests, and I'll see if I can incorporate those into with the Slack Key, you know, as the sort of the running the thread that goes through the whole thing, you know. So that one's a little different than my normal ones. And I have a new one coming out on February 23rd.
Okay.
It's called Moku Maluhia, which means peaceful island. And it's really going to be a super chill. It's a real super chilled Slack Key CD. It's the kind of thing you just really want to lower your blood pressure and chill out and, you know, and it's got some beautiful cover art painting by this great Big Island artist named Harry Wishard. And just a beautiful painting. It's just a very serene thing all around, you know, musically and visually. So, that's coming out the 23rd, so that's exciting.
That's wonderful. That sounds so good. I love that. how did you learn it from? I don't think we went through that. Who did you learn it from, or how did
Slack
you learn?
Key? Well, I just learned myself. You know, I mean,
really?
I listen to records. I'm basically self-taught, so I've learned everything on my own. I always like to have a perfect record, no lessons or no classes. I was an art major in college, so But I had friends, you know, a lot of the people I was playing with in groups were in bands were in the music department. And, you know, so, I mean, I learned a lot just from people I played with. And, but I'm self-taught. So, I just learned from listening to the records, really. And then, but, you know, I didn't, I wasn't very concerned with trying to duplicate, you know, various slack key players' sounds. Mm-hmm. I've used it more of a springboard for my own compositions.
Okay.
You know, it was like, I compose new songs with that feeling,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't try to completely, you know, duplicate a famous player's, you know, riffs
right.
or anything. I just did my own thing, but based on that sound, you know. And I always have kind of done that. You know?
That's incredibly freeing.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, some of this traditional stuff is so wonderful. It's like, well, why would you want to try and recreate that? You
I know, can
they
see
did
that.
It. They did it so well. It's like it can't be done any better.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, when I do live shows, I do pull some of that stuff out because people will recognize them. And
okay,
I'll pull some of those songs out, the more traditional ones, you know, and I'll mix it up. I'll play the traditional ones and I'll play my own stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, but yeah, I just. You know, it's all music. I just do what feels good to me. You know,
yeah.
And I like slack key, and I have a lot of other influences. So whatever, I guess what comes out is just a mashup of all that.
Yeah. Do you have any of the old records? Any of the old slack key records you were talking about, going back to the
40s? Yeah, you know, I have a lot of stuff on CD, but lately I've been collecting the vinyl of some of the. I'm especially interested in the ones that I first heard. You
mm-hmm.
know? So especially when I'm in Hawaii, I or anywhere really, but it's especially in Hawaii. If I'm in like a antique store or a secondhand store, I'll go through the records and try and find some of that old vinyl. So I've got a pretty good stack of old vinyl from the ones that I first heard.
Yeah,
the real legendary ones like Gabby Painui and people like that. I've got a bunch of those records now. I'm pretty good stack of mm-hmm. vinyl. You know, I try and find some that are in good shape, and so. Yeah, I've been collecting them, and like I say, I've got a lot of stuff on CD, but
yeah,
but it's just nice to have the vinyl because that's what I first heard.
For sure. Yeah. Are any of those old ones out of print, like have never been turned into CDs, do you know?
Yeah, there's quite a few that weren't turned into CDs. There was a gentleman named Michael Cord in Ventura who just recently passed away, but he was a great archiver. He would find a lot of those old records
mm-hmm.
and that were out of print, and he would buy up the master from whoever owned it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would restore it and then release it on CD. And he had hundreds of titles, you know.
Wow.
Not just slack key, but old Hawaiian music.
That's cool.
So he was responsible for, you know, for keeping a lot of that stuff from just going into the garbage
sure.
can, you know, because otherwise it would have just deteriorated and it would have just thrown in the trash, you
wow.
know. So these records were ones that were long out of print that he restored and you know, like I say, bought up the masters too. So... He did a great job of that, and everybody's real thankful. But yeah, there's quite a few of them that are out of print, and some of them have, you know, I think some of them were released on CD when the CD format came out, and then, you know, they probably made a certain number of them,
yeah,
and that
yeah.
was it, you know. They decided, well, we're not going to release them anymore, but I'm sure nowadays you can find them, you know, on the internet or streaming somewhere or something. You can find a lot of that stuff. But,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, Michael Cord did a great thing. I've got some of his compilation CDs, and they're really, really special because you just can't find that stuff.
Sure, and I bet that stuff you can't find here on the mainland that often at all.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, wow. It'd be very hard to find. So
that's so,
so
cool.
I keep my eyes, you know, peeled for, you know, when I'm in a thrift shop or a secondhand or antique store, anywhere that has, you know, used vinyl. I definitely keep my eyes open for that stuff, you know,
because
it's a real score when you do find it. Yeah,
that's so great. It's not often on this show where we get to talk about comedy and then also talk about a totally different type of art that I know nothing about. I really, this is a huge education. I love this so much. I don't know off the top of my head when this episode comes out, in a few weeks,
mm-hmm.
but let's again say when the name of your album, when it comes out, and then where people can find you online, Twitter and stuff.
Yeah, the new record is called Moku Maluhia, Peaceful Island, and it's going to be out February 23rd, and it'll be on all the Amazon, CD Baby, iTunes. It's coming out, and then also into the streaming services, Pandora
great.
And Spotify, and all the major streaming services. So it's, you know, the only place it won't be is on the shelf at Walmart.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
But it's not going to be there, but it will be in all the traditional. CD Baby is a good place I recommend if you actually want to get the physical CD or any of my CDs. They're all on Amazon and CD Baby and iTunes and all the streaming stuff. So it's and if you want an actual direct link, you can go to my website. It's jimkimowest.com. JimKimowest. Chemo is what they call me in Hawaii. Chemo is basically the Hawaiian name for Jim or James.
Oh, okay.
Because they don't have a J. You know, there's a lot of consonants they don't have in Hawaiian language. They don't have a J.
All right.
So they come up with these approximations. So if you're Jim or Jim, they call you Chemo.
That's great.
You know, and like if you were Robert, it's Lopaka, you know.
Interesting.
So that's why it's Chemo, jimkimowest.com. So if you go there, it's, you know, there's links to all that stuff there. And
that's perfect.
Yeah.
And you're on Twitter? Right?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. It's Westernmost is my Twitter handle. Westernmost is my record label, you know. So it's really a record label Twitter account. I should have my own personal one, but it's the record label Westernmost. So I'm on Twitter and Facebook and Jim Chemo West on Facebook. I have a couple pages there. I have a personal page and I have a you know, music page.
Oh, sure,
too,
sure,
you know.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, I'm out there in all the social media worlds. And then this Sunday I'll be playing at the Southern California Slack Key Festival in Redondo Beach, which is my 11th year playing there.
Really?
So, yeah.
That's nuts.
I've played there every year for 11 years.
That's crazy.
Yeah. It's a great show. It's really fun. And
that's wonderful.
Yeah, just the turnout is great. It's a nice, it's like about a 1500 seat venue, and it's always sold out or close to it, and so much appreciation. I'm the only artist from the mainland playing this year. Everybody else is from Hawaii, and it's really the Hawaii musicians love it because they oftentimes in Hawaii these guys are really talented, but they're playing at a hotel bar or something, and they're kind of, you know, they're just sort of in the background.
Sure,
and people
sure.
are like, come over with a tip and go, hey, play Tiny Bubbles,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
whatever,
yeah.
you know. So they come over here and they've got 1500 people who are just listening to every note and
that's
just
great.
Loving everything they do, and they just, you know, they just like, wow, I can't believe it.
I
know?
Love it. That's so good.
So they all the Hawaiian musicians love coming over to play at this show. So
that's awesome. Well, yeah. I mean I've now found another form of music that I'm gonna start looking out for just based on this idea. This has been very fun and really wonderful for you to come on.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. It's been fun for me too. Anytime.
I've said this before. The one time I've met Al and I said it to Bermuda, I'll say it to you. Your guys' music is the reason I am best friends with my best friend. So your work's been very, very important to me. And
wow,
it's
awesome.
It's an honor to meet you, an honor for you to give me some of your time. It's very cool of you.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's really it. I'm not going to promote my dumb crap. So I want you guys go to jimkimowest.com. Everything is there. Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing.
Aloha.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.
A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.